You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Scientists have been searching for life on Mars for 60 years now. The planet, described by Italian astronomer Giovanni Schiaparelli in 1877 as an earthly paradise, turns out, upon closer inspection, to be a rather hostile place, parched and frozen with a thin atmosphere. While it has sunlight, water, carbon, and nitrogen, we've yet to find so much as a single indication of life there. Here to discuss the latest chapter in NASA's Mars exploration is New Yorker reporter-at-large Burkhard Bilger, whose recent article, The Martian Chroniclers, A New Era in Planetary Exploration, provides a behind-the-scenes look at the Mars landing that was most recent, the one that involved Curiosity, and Adam Stelzer, the NASA engineer who led the entry, descent, and landing team for Curiosity, which has been gathering soil samples, running tests on various materials collected, and sending back data at a rate so rapid it's hard for NASA scientists to keep up. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So how many spacecraft were sent to Mars before Curiosity?
There were 39 before Curiosity, and Curiosity was the 40th.
And what did those 39 do anything good? I mean, Curiosity just seems to be so much better.
Well, 40% of them didn't even make it to Mars.
Wasn't one of them sent up with the wrong specs, a combination of inches and meters that led to a real problem?
I'll let Adam respond to that because it's a more complicated story than I think the media usually gives it credit for.
Yeah, we did lose a mission to Mars in 99. It was the Mars Climactic Orbiter. And we lost it because one column in the entries of a particular data file, which was supposed to be in SI units and was flagged as SI units, was in fact in English units.
Well, how could somebody do something like that? I guess Curiosity didn't have that problem.
Well, it ends up, I mean, in that case, it ends up being something called the Small Forces File, which is a file that estimates the non-gravitational forces, like solar wind pressure. So it's a very small file that describes not easily measured quantities. And unfortunately, over the distance from Earth to Mars, they added up to pushing the spacecraft in a direction that was not recoverable.
Was Curiosity developed with an understanding of what had gone wrong or had not been good enough about the previous spacecraft?
Yes, we try each time to learn from our successes and our failures, and typically we learn a little bit more from our failures than our successes because we look more closely at those. And so Curiosity was designed with everything that we had learned to date.
Now let's start with one of the more remarkable discoveries from Curiosity. What can you tell us about Gale Crater?
Well, Gale Crater was the site that we decided to put the rover down into. It was a challenge to get her there because it's a although it's a very large crater, it has a massive mountain in the middle of it, rising higher than anything in the continental U.S., and we had to squeeze her down beside the mountain, between the crater wall and the mountain.
And why did you choose that site?
The scientists chose it. So I'm an engineer. There's a great dichotomy between the folks who build the spacecraft and the folks that operate the spacecraft. Scientists ask for it, and we just make it.
Because they suspected that it had been a lake?
They had looked, and they saw from orbit indications that waterborne minerals looked like they were present, and that suggested that there had been water present and that may have been a habitable environment.
Though I should say, with Gale originally, there were other sites that had better evidence of water and waterborne minerals than Gale, but the geology seemed to be so interesting. They had this mountain that had these very clear sedimentary layers, and they thought, well, even if we don't find organic molecules or signs of life, we have this lovely kind of geological record that can tell us this is the prehistory of Mars.
But then you have to time the launch and everything so that Curiosity arrives just at the right moment. Mars has turned just its face just right, and we're not going to go too high, too low.
Yes, it is a challenge. We have only a few minutes in which we can launch Curiosity and make that trajectory.
Now, Burkhard, at the time of their beginnings, 4.5 billion years ago, Mars and Earth were very much alike, weren't they?
Absolutely. I mean, Mars is a much smaller planet, but they had liquid water. They had atmospheres. They're in the, what astronomers call the Goldilocks zone, which is close enough to the sun to be warm, but not so close as to make it inhospitable. They had kind of all the elements, chemical elements and atmospheric elements to foster life. But then the two planets kind of went off in a different direction.
And what are some of the theories for why that happened?
I think the prevailing theory now is that Mars is simply too small, that it's even though it's only it's half the radius or half the diameter of Earth, it's, I think, what is it, a tenth the total volume of Earth. And that's just not quite enough to keep that atmosphere close.
Now, could there be life there just of a sort that we wouldn't be able to recognize? Because we always assume that for there to be life, there have to be certain conditions that we have on Earth. But couldn't there be life that didn't depend on oxygen, for example?
Oh, sure. The old Star Trek ideas of silicon-based life forms. And
right. We certainly could have life that we don't that's very different than life as we understand it. And in the past, at least, and even possibly today, there could be life that is like we understand it. We have not found it yet, but we have...
It could be microbial.
It would probably need to be microbial, need to be very low, primitive levels of life. But we have determined that the ancient environment at Mars, when it was wet and had surface water... would have been habitable for the development of life.
Adam, can you describe all the things Curiosity was built to do?
Oh, not in the amount of time that we have.
Okay, most of the important things.
She was packed full. You know, we put rovers down on the surface of Mars, first in 97 and then again in 2004.
And what did they discover?
In 97, the big discovery in 97 was really that we could get to the surface of Mars for under one-tenth what we had spent in the era of Viking. And that was fantastic. And that sort of spurred us on to eventually put the twin rovers Spirit and Opportunity down in 2004.
And how were we able to do it for so much less than we had expected?
Many things contributed to that. One, that which we had learned about the Martian environment from Viking helped us range in the designs.
You mean just, for example, the gravitational pull?
More the amount of atmosphere that it had, the temperatures that the surface was, allowed us to design less conservative, less robust system that could handle any possible environment. And then we took more risk. A Pathfinder, the little tiny rover, was put on the surface of Mars in 97, back in an era where we were experimenting with something called faster, better, cheaper at NASA. And we were embracing risk and seeing if what we could do for less money. That spurred us on to putting Spirit and Opportunity on the surface. And they taught us that there had been liquid water on the surface of Mars. And that's a big deal because we know here that water and life are highly correlated on Earth. But they couldn't tell us details about the water, how long it had been present, what its salinity or pH had been.
Whether but water is water, isn't it? H2O?
It is, but whether it's salty or acidic or basic can have an influence on whether life can exist and whether it would have been habitable for life. And so that's where Curiosity comes in. And she has a total of 11 instruments. She can understand the chemical composition of rocky materials from 30 feet away by zapping them with a laser and looking at the vapor, doing spectral analysis on the vapor. She has got an analytical chemistry lab, basically, on board, and she can powder rocky material, grind it up, and then look at the material in the laboratory.
What's the Sky Crane?
The Sky Crane is how we got that big rover filled with all of that science equipment onto the surface. So to deliver such a large rover, we needed to invent a new way of landing her. And this way has sort of a jet backpack lowering her onto the surface, and we call that move the Sky Crane.
And obviously it's a tricky thing because what did you say 40% of all of the launches never made it?
Yes.
What are the reasons they never made it? We just launched them a little too soon, a little too late, or we had other kinds of miscalculations?
A range. Well, so that 40% number includes the Soviet Union, who's had a lot worse luck than we have, unfortunately.
That's why it no longer exists.
That is. Look what happened to them. They couldn't make it to the surface of Mars, and that's it. A variety of things, from blowing up on launch to dying on cruise on the way there to dying at landing.
When you say dying, we're not talking about people. All of these missions have been robotic.
Absolutely. But for the makers of robots, we think of them as almost being lifelike. So,
I mean, the one that was often talked about at NASA when I was there is the Polar Lander, which was the one right before Spirit and Opportunity. And it was especially poignant because it was going to land on the Martian pole and seemed to be like it was going to really tell us some wonderful things about it.
And that was important because the pole would have had ice.
Exactly. And what happened with the Polar Lander was it was a legged lander. It was supposed to land on these legs and they were supposed to unfold. But when it, as it was landing, they now think, and the legs deployed, the spacecraft mistook them for actually touching down on the surface. So they cut off its thrusters and the thing plummeted, 130 feet, I think, to the surface.
80 meters, yeah.
And was never heard from again.
Because when it fell, all the equipment broke?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's not made to land, fall that kind of distance, 13 stories.
I mean, the number of things that have to go right for something like this to make it the 355 million miles or something is unbelievable.
There was the concept of the rover on a rope.
Right. That's a progenitor of what ultimately took us to the sky crane. But the idea of landing the rover directly on its wheels appealed to us because rovers are designed to accommodate the Martian terrain, to adjust to it, to have good traction on it. And so why not use that equipment as your landing gear and just deposit the rover directly onto the surface?
Because the alternative would be for it to fall on its side or on its top, and then you'd have to wiggle it. Would you be able to maneuver it around so that it could go back on its wheels?
No, if we don't put it down on its wheels, we're done. Where the mission dies, the robot is lost.
And that probably happened a couple of times as well?
That never happened. Nope.
Oh.
Nope. We had tried to put rovers on the surface only in the airbag lander system that we used for Spirit and Opportunity and the Mars Pathfinder mission.
My guests are Adam Stelzner, who is the engineer who worked on getting the Curiosity onto the moon, Burkhard Bilger, who's written about the mission in an article called The Martian Chroniclers, A New Era in Planetary Exploration. It's in the April 22nd issue of The New Yorker. Stay with us for more. We're back with Burkhard Bilger, who wrote an article called The Martian Chroniclers, A New Era in Planetary Exploration for The New Yorker's April 22nd edition, and Adam Stelzner of NASA, the engineer one of the engineers anyway, responsible for getting Curiosity onto Mars and helping it continue to do incredible work. Did the same people work on all these different missions, or did they keep on bringing in people until they got it right?
Well, the missions happen over a long period of time. For instance, the development of Curiosity and getting her safely to the surface took over 10 years. And so the previous mission, Spirit and Opportunity, took us 3 or 4 years to get her to the get them to the surface. So you don't have the same people working each one of these. Although for Curiosity, we did have a lot of the team that put Spirit and Opportunity on the surface.
I should say, I mean, it's astonishing how many people work on a project like this. I mean, JPL estimates, I think, was 7,000 people total who had their hand in some way in the Curiosity project.
Because first you have the people who actually have to design the rocket and then the module, and then you have the other people who take over once it's landed on Mars.
There's the landing system. There's the rover itself. There's the scientists who are designing experiments for that machinery. And, you know, there are people who will spend years doing one thing, designing one small component, you know, the lens for the camera or the thruster or so forth.
How long is the trip?
The trip took about 7.5 months.
So there's a lot of anxiety for 7.5 months, I'd imagine.
Yes. Yes.
And then when it gets closer and closer, you're in the control room.
Yeah.
And total anxiety.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There's very little you can do to during the landing event, we're all along for the ride. We're just observers. We're audience members like the rest of the world. Prior to the landing event, during the we call it cruise, that time between launch and entry, descent, and landing, that time period, we can double check things, make sure the spacecraft's in good working health, run tests on Earth to double check things, and we do all of that. We were working furiously all the way up until the landing event. But the landing event, we are audience members.
Because a certain amount of luck is involved, as we learned in previous missions.
Certainly there is some luck involved, but more importantly, it's about 14 minutes for a signal to get from Mars back to Earth. And so you can't the landing event takes 7 minutes. So the entire landing event has occurred when you first get the first signal that the landing's starting to happen. So there's no way for us to control it during landing. It's an autonomous event. The spacecraft, we've taken all that we know and understand, and we've packed that into the software that's running on the spacecraft. And then she's responding to the stimulus of the Martian environment as she flies in. And if she does a good job, we end up jumping up and down and being very happy at the end.
17 minutes because that's the speed of a radio signal?
Yes, it takes 14 minutes for light to make it from Mars to Earth.
You're sending it at the speed of light?
Yes.
So what has Curiosity found over the past number of months? Has it discovered anything extremely, excitingly different from what we have known in the past?
It's added a tremendous amount to what we knew in the past. What we knew in the past was that there had been water on the surface of Mars in a liquid form for some amount of time.
But we didn't know, as you said, the salinity of it, for example.
For example, or all sorts of attributes of it. We also didn't know how long it had been on the surface of Mars. And within weeks of being on the surface, she'd found a riverbed, which told the geologists that there had been water flowing maybe hip deep on the surface of Mars for thousands of years. So right there, that's a big piece in the puzzle of habitability. Do you have liquid water present in for periods of time that could be conceivably long enough to
I mean, it's the first site that we've ever found outside of the Earth that is provably habitable.
Now, why did the water disappear? Do we know?
I mean, if Mars is too small to hold its atmosphere close, the notion is that eventually maybe the mantle cooled and the magnetic field was disrupted and the atmosphere kind of just evaporated into space. You get solar winds coming down. There's this notion, you know, there are alternative theories. You know, an asteroid could have hit the planet and blasted a lot of the atmosphere into space. But one way or another, we know that at a certain point it just evaporated.
Is part of the problem that asteroids do hit every planet and we might discover something and say, wow, isn't this great? This is something about Mars we never knew and it actually turns out to have come from somewhere else?
Possibly.
Because we just recently discovered some ancient things. I guess I just read in the paper the other day that it came in an asteroid that carried something from perhaps as far off as the Big Bang. And there it is under the Arctic ice cap.
Some of the compounds that are necessary for life, we believe, are seeded into the inner solar system by comets and other low-density objects that come from the outer solar system. And they bring in these very important substances that are building blocks of life. That life evolved on another planet and may have been brought here is a possibility. Mm-hmm. We found a
I saw that movie, 2001.
We found a meteorite several years back that we believed might have had a microbe from the surface of Mars. So transport of rocky material and potentially life-bearing material from one planet to another is a possibility.
My guests are Adam Seltzer of NASA and Burkhard Bilger, who has written an article called The Martian Chroniclers, A New Era in Planetary Exploration for The New Yorker, the April 22nd issue. Some of the space probes have experienced a lot longer life than anybody imagined. Others seem to turn off unexpectedly. Do we have any idea of why?
We usually do. We convince ourselves certainly that we do. The reason that they live longer is usually that we are very conservative. We try to be very conservative in how we build them, and we make conservative assumptions of the environment. For instance, we think if it's going to be hot in the day and cold at night, we think it's going to be hotter than it actually is and colder than it actually is. And when we get there, specifically, things like those temperature swings, if they're not as big as we anticipated, the vehicle actually lasts longer because it's not going through this as severe thermal cycles.
Are there fixes that you can make to Curiosity from Earth?
There are fixes that we can make to her software and her behaviors, but we cannot fix her hardware. If she breaks a bracket or a fitting, it's broken forever.
But we should talk about
the software. You can recharge her.
I mean, for instance, they had to reboot the software recently because there was some corruption to the memory, as I understand it.
That's right.
And that was scary, I think, because it has two processors, right? And they had to go on one and let the other one get rebooted. But there's always a fear that if that one also corrupts, we're cooked.
That's
well,
right.
When I have to reboot my Wi-Fi, I just simply pull the plugs out and then put them back in.
That's right.
A little more complicated.
Well, it's certainly more complicated if you can't touch it. Right. And so we have two computers on the spacecraft, and when it's time to reboot the computer that's operating, we go to the backup computer or the computer that was previously backup, and that becomes prime, and then we reboot what is now the backup computer. And we do that specifically. We have two computers just to avoid some of the risks. You know, sometimes your laptop freezes, and unless you can pull the plug or push the power button, it will stay frozen forever. Well, if a spacecraft does that and it has just what computer, it's frozen for all time and it's dead to us.
Mm-hmm. Are there other rovers on Mars that are dead to us?
There are rovers. The only other rover on Mars is active and alive and functioning, and that's a rover named Opportunity.
Mm-hmm. But Spirit is stuck and dead.
Spirit
right?
is stuck and we believe dead. Mm-hmm. Dead as in non-functioning.
And what is Opportunity doing that Curiosity is not doing, or are they duplicating each other?
So Opportunity has now been on the surface of Mars since early in 2004, so we're coming up on 9 years.
Wow.
She's solar powered. She's smaller than this desktop here. And she has a much more limited set of experiments that she can do. And so she is roving on the plains of Meridiani. It's a particular location, and taking science measurements, mostly images at this point, of that plane. But that is a very, very small subset of the science that Curiosity can do. And Curiosity is in a totally different place on the planet, looking, boring holes into rocks, getting underneath the weathering rind, pulling out virgin rocky material in powder form, and doing analytical chemistry experiments on it.
I mean, part of what happened with the evolution of the rovers is that NASA got better and better images of the surface. And along with that, more and more precise landing systems that allowed them to go to more interesting spots. So you have Opportunity and Spirit landed in places that were intriguing compared to what had come before. They gave evidence of liquid water. But Opportunity has been kind of roving in a wasteland for 9 years. And at a certain point, there was not that much more interesting stuff to be learned.
Does NASA have hope of landing something on the polar cap again?
We actually landed a polar lander in 2008 called Phoenix. And it confirmed that there was liquid, there was salt. There was water ice under the poles of Mars, which we had some strong suspicions of from orbital data, but it confirmed that, which was good.
Well, do we know now the nature of this water as a result of Curiosity?
As a result of Curiosity, we know that the ancient environment was habitable for life. Mm-hmm. We know that there's water present on the surface of Mars in solid form, ice, and that
Is it saline? Is it does it have a lot of acidity?
The material up in the polar region is not saline or highly acidic. There is also speculation, and this is really mostly from orbital observations, that there may be pockets of liquid water underneath the surface, because there appear to be spontaneous flows out into the onto the surface of Mars of what looks like water. But we can't catch that in the act, and we have not, through Curiosity or any other device, been able to positively identify that.
I'd like to ask real quickly, if you had as precise a landing system as possible, where would you go on Mars? Is there a spot that has been too dangerous to get to, but that you think would be an amazing spot to go?
Well, so that's a question that we ask the scientists all the time. You know, how precise do you want it to be?
Because you handle the engineering side.
We handle the engineering, and my specialty is landing. And they come back, and really the challenge for the precision lander is in the effort of returning samples to Earth. So we have always, the scientists have always identified that no matter how crafty or ingenious they might be in cramming their laboratories into small packages and putting them on the surface of Mars, you're always likely to find that you want to make a measurement that you don't have in your pocket. And so the real thing to do is to choose wisely material from the surface of Mars and then bring it back to Earth. To do that, we have to go there, find it, make a cache, and then go and meet that cache. And that is where it becomes, where precision is really called for. So that's what will, if we ever decide to return samples from Mars, that's the kind of thing that will drive precision.
We'll have to send something there to pick up Curiosity and bring it back, or at least a part of Curiosity.
That's what you'd have to do. And it won't be Curiosity. It'll be some mission in the future, perhaps. But the way you would do that is you'd put a mission on the surface, you'd comb over the surface, choosing wisely rocks and samples to be brought back to Earth, and then go and pick up the sample and bring it back.
Adam, hasn't your road to NASA been rather unconventional? What did you do before?
My road to NASA has perhaps been, you know, many roads to NASA are not the ones that people think in their minds. Mine involved some years playing rock and roll and a small misspent youth.
Well, that doesn't sound like something that would lead you into a career as an engineer dealing with rocket ships.
It ends up being that I became curious about, well, I had not paid much attention in high school. I'd paid so little attention that when I happened to notice, returning from playing a show late one night, that the stars were in a different place in the sky than they had been when I went to the show, I was awestruck. Why were those stars moving? And that spark of curiosity is what eventually led me here.
Burkhardt, you spoke to the people at NASA. Do you have a sense of what the next mission will be?
Well, there are two missions that have already been slated. One is another polar lander, as I understand it. And there's another rover like Curiosity that's planned for 2020. Is that correct?
That's correct.
I mean, I think the sample return mission is the one that everybody would like to do. But NASA budgets depend on government appropriations, and whether they can get enough momentum to get that is not clear yet.
And do you think we'll ever see a manned mission?
Well, I know an awful lot of astronauts who would love to see one of those. And I think it's possible for us to do that. It's down the road a ways, and there's a significant investment involved.
Well, since we are twin planets, there's probably a lot that we could get from Mars if we ever think about the ethical side of whether we should start mining minerals from another planet. People have also talked about doing that with the moon. I don't know. It upsets me to think about it.
Yes. People, the moon, the asteroids, Mars, there are groups that look at mining all of these celestial bodies.
Thank you both so much for being on our show. Adam Stelzner of NASA and Burkhardt Bilger, whose article, The Martian Chroniclers, A New Era in Planetary Exploration, was in the April 22nd issue of The New Yorker. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Good talking to you.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.